This hour of the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by Northwest Safe. There's a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
So Biscuit Bitch is a restaurant cafe in Seattle. Pardon the language. That's what it's called. And the owner wrote a rather scathing letter to the Seattle City Council. King 5 was the first that I saw to post it. And this letter is absolutely glorious because it hits at every single thing that's wrong in the city of Seattle, a city that's become worse and worse and worse for businesses, particularly small businesses, their employees, and ultimately the customers. These are issues that aren't coming up every once in a while. These are issues that are coming up daily. And it's making life here rather impossible. And so I'm not going to read the whole letter, which will be available later at ktth.com, but I wanted to read parts of it. Because it tells you exactly how far the city has devolved. Kimmy Spice is the owner of the cafe. She owns three spots, all in Seattle, all very close to one another. She says, "Dear council members, you know, at first I tried to appeal to you while keeping a cool head, but I am so angry right now at the way the city treats small businesses. Every time I turn around, I'm paying a new tax for a sign permit or an awning or a table outside, B&O tax, sugar tax, a myriad of licenses, elevator permits, health permits, higher property taxes that are passed on to my triple net. And what do I get in return from the city? Streets that take over an hour to get less than 1 mile from one of my shops to another to transfer my products because my commercial vehicle is not allowed to drive down Third Avenue anymore. Construction everywhere, leaving no place to park delivery vehicles and blocking the customer entrances to my businesses, making my shops filthy with exhaust and dust and making my employees feel ill all summer long." She goes on to say, "My lease term is coming up in February at the Belltown Inn, and I will leave before I change my excellent benefit structure. You go tell my employees in all three of my shops that they will no longer get their summer profit-sharing check, because now I will instead be paying 100% instead of 75% of all my employees' insurance they never use anyway because they're young and healthy." She goes on to say that people aren't coming to my cafe because they're just in town. Maybe they're at the hotel across the street. People come here. They wait in long lines to get our food here. But that's starting to change because she is in an area in Belltown that is, quote, notorious for junkies, panhandlers, and drug dealers. Before we were there, the business never lasted. Even the Euro chain restaurant that was there at one point went out of business because it's a notoriously sketchy block. The vagrants and dealers will take over our storefront." They say that they're dealing with problems that we've talked about on a regular basis. They say that this is a city that is notorious for junkies, panhandlers, and drug dealers. How many times do we have to highlight these concerns before the city does anything? And it's not me asking a rhetorical question. I legitimately want to know. I legitimately want to know how many times do any of us, whether or not we live in Seattle, work in Seattle, visit Seattle, have friends in Seattle, hear about Seattle, how many times do we have to have these conversations before the city does anything? And the answer is they're never going to do anything unless we force it. And the only way that we can force it is making sure that we are backing people who are running for office, who are going to replace the horrible council members who are currently on the council who are running for re-election. We're talking about people like Shama Sawan, who's running up against Egan O'Ryan. Egan is a progressive, but he actually cares about businesses. We're talking about Lisa Herbold, a disaster of a council member. She's running up against Phil Tavel, way better on every single issue. We're talking about Deborah Juarez, a council member who has no idea what she's doing, and most people don't know what she's doing because she doesn't really give a damn enough to talk to you. She's running against Ann Davison Sattler, who's meeting as many people as humanly possible. We have people who are running for council who can help take control of the situation that's getting worse and worse and worse every single day. And we're going to continue to see letters like this happening over and over and over again some more. And we're going to continue to hear about stories of kids having coffee thrown in their face by a mentally ill, prolific offender. You're going to continue to hear stories of people who are visiting from out of state, tourists who get attacked by homeless folks, because this council does not care. They're really interested in symbolism. They absolutely love to virtue signal. They do not care about this city. You do. And you know that the bad policies of Seattle tend to spread. You know that just because you live in Sammamish or Enumclaw or Yelm or Everett or Tacoma or Olympia or Bellingham, you know that bad policies spread. That's why we're all in this together, to try to defeat these people who are running for re-election because of what they're doing. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Celebrity news.
So despite calls for a boycott of Dancing with the Stars because they dared to put Sean Spicer on the air as a contestant, they had really, really good ratings. Last night was the first night for Dancing with the Stars, a show that, frankly, I don't quite understand. I mean, I know what it's about. You get B-level celebrities and C-level celebrities who don't know how to dance. You pair them up with professional dancers. They suck it up. And then you vote for them. And then by the end, you've got two people who still can't really dance, but are slightly better than where they were 12 weeks earlier.
Yeah, I'm not big on the show.
I don't understand it.
It's popular. They have a great point, though. I've always wanted to see a regular average Joe in the Olympics just to see how much better these Olympians are. This is exactly what they're doing.
It's so weird because I've never wanted to see that ever. And you know what? I never wanted to see Sean Spicer dance in what looked like a Big Bird outfit with really, really tight white pants. But I got to see him do that last night. And not just that, but he also played the bongo drums. He was just slamming on those a lot. I don't know why. I don't think that that is normal. In this, they were dancing to a Spice Girls song, which, yeah, again, not entirely sure I know why. Didn't really go so well. Of course, people, because they hate Sean Spicer because of his direct connection as former White House spokesperson to Donald Trump, they want to pretend that he, and this is Daily Beast, says, Sean Spicer has most embarrassing Dancing with the Stars debut ever, period. I don't know if that's true because I don't watch the show, but I've certainly seen clips of stuff that's just equally as bad. I think people just don't like Sean Spicer. I will say this. He was having a good time.
He had a blast.
Oh, my God. I mean, the smile on his face. And I kind of know Sean in the sense of I've spent some time with him. He was the speaker last year at the Washington State annual GOP dinner, which, of course, I emceed because I'm the absolute best in the world. And we had some time to chat. He's a really nice guy. He's down to earth, regardless of anyone's position on what he did as a White House spokesperson. I think he's a really good guy. And when I saw him dance, it was kind of adorable.
It was great.
It was embarrassing. It was cringy, right? But it was adorable.
It was great to see somebody like that just act like a child.
Totally. And that's a perfect way to explain it. He was acting like a child. The judges...
He was going bonkers with the bongos. What were you doing there? He was like being attacked by a swarm of wasps. I have no idea. But I actually have to say, there was some elements of salsa there. Not always on time or on rhythm. And, you know, and your hip action, at times, it looked like they were setting cement, your hip. You have to get them going a little bit more, but I have to say it was strangely entertaining.
This is the worst part of any kind of judgment, when they say things like this.
Well, I admire your courage coming on this show, and as the others have said, you brought fun to the ballroom. Well done.
Like, the whole idea, it takes courage to stand up there and act like a jackass, and so that's not good. Review.
That was a participation award at its finest. A verbal one.
It was barely a participation award. Like, that's how bad it was. So he ends up, you know, thanking everybody for what they did to help him get to where he was. Here he's talking with Aaron Andrews.
When Jerry Seinfeld told you to wear this shirt, right? This is fantastic. He didn't. It just looks like that shirt. How are you feeling from that?
I feel good. I think Lindsay's made a lot of progress since we started.
Right. We appreciate that from
That's
her.
Funny. That's the thing.
No, honestly, as you saw the package, I started off at minus 10.
It happened.
And she's been a phenomenal coach, patient, very patient.
Yes.
And I've had had a blast doing this.
And like Alan said, you committed to this role.
Look at what I'm wearing.
We can't miss it, Sean. I hate to tell you that.
This is payback for every single person is going, you wore that shirt.
Very well.
He's just so likable. And so on Twitter, he put out a tweet that says, clearly the judge aren't going to be with me. Let's send a message to Hollywood that those of us who stand for Christ won't be discounted. May God bless you. I don't necessarily know if that's the right way to position this, but there are going to be a lot of people who are going to vote with him or for him, regardless of whether or not they even saw Dancing with the Stars, because they know what this stands for. Right now, this is almost like a vote on Donald Trump. Everyone hated on him after he was announced as part of the show, and folks all across the country are either Trump supporters or sick and tired of what Democrats are doing and turning everything like this politicized. I think a lot of them are going to come out. The question is, can they come out in big enough numbers to save him? Because ultimately, it was not a really good performance. But he was so happy.
Yeah, at least we got to see a smile at the bare minimum.
At least we will remember that and the Big Bird outfit forever. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text message on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. Keep those text messages coming. 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending in the media?
So Robin Pogrebin and Kate Kelly were confronted by some folks over at The View, mainly Meghan McCain and Abby Huntsman. These are the two reporters who printed that hit piece against Justice Brett Kavanaugh in the New York Times over the weekend. The article was all about a recent recent unearthed example of something that happened supposedly in the 80s when Kavanaugh was at Yale and he was this drunken frat boy. And to show you that he mistreats people and has a history of the kind of antics that we heard he was accused of when he was, you know, being considered for the Supreme Court justice position that, of course, he ended up getting. You know, they said, this is outrageous. You know what happened? At a drunken dorm party with the help of some friends, he essentially assaulted a young woman by putting his manhood in the hands of this woman who was drunk at the time. Now, this was a big deal. This shows you how much of a degenerate Brett Kavanaugh is. Kamala Harris, Beto O'Rourke, it's time to impeach Brett Kavanaugh. He clearly lied to the American people, and he lied under oath when he said he never did stuff like this before. What they did not include in the New York Times piece is that the so-called victim doesn't recollect anything. She didn't go on record saying anything. She does not believe she is a victim. That's kind of important. I thought it was all about believe all women. I guess it's believe all women, except when they say things that don't fit into a political agenda that we have. Then at that point, stop believing them. Listen to the so-called witness who just happens to be a hardcore Clinton advisor, which seems kind of important to disclose, but they really didn't. But for Kate Kelly, she says, actually, we had no intention of keeping that information from the public.
First of all, there was no desire to withhold important information from our readers.
But you did. I'll let you finish in a second. But you did. And it was pointed out very quickly on Twitter, and it took you guys a very long time, despite you saying the opposite, to actually update and correct the story.
We have all of it in the book, and the essay is an adaptation of the book that, of course, we had to edit for length and clarity.
You know what? I get that you sometimes have to edit for length and clarity. That is absolutely true. You cannot just reprint an entire chapter. Feels like you could probably put a sentence in there. Fit in a sentence that said the so-called victim has no recollection of this whatsoever, is not on the record anywhere, doesn't want to talk to anybody about it, and doesn't actually believe that she's a victim.
The thrust of the essay was about, probably a bad word choice, the point of the essay was about Deborah Ramirez, a woman who had gone to college with Justice Kavanaugh and had this experience where she alleged that he exposed himself to her, and it was a very troubling event. And we lay out all the reasons why that was, not just the moment itself, but the experience she was having at Yale being very difficult. Within that, we talked about this new, as yet unreported allegation because we thought it was germane. It was a similar...
Just real quick again, and my apologies to Kelly, I'll let her finish. It was not undiscovered until recently. Washington Post had this story last year. They chose not to do anything with it because it was unsubstantiated. Kind of an important detail.
Or type of situation to the Ramirez one. During the editing process, there was an oversight and this key detail about the fact that the woman herself has told friends she doesn't remember it and has not wanted to talk about it got cut. And it was an oversight.
Weird.
And the Times adjusted it. And we're very sorry that it happened.
Yeah. You sound really sorry because you're using this as a way to promote your book and make money off of it. And it's so weird how such a key piece of information just happened to be edited out by accident. Definitely no intent there. It just so happened the biggest part of that story that completely pushes back at your main claim was deleted. And somehow you were not able to figure that out.
Her name is in the book because we think it's relevant information and we think it's accurate.
Oh, by the way. They chose on The View not to use the woman's name because she doesn't want any of this attention. Because she doesn't recall any of this. Because she doesn't want her name dragged through a political firestorm. They chose to do it anyway in the book.
And we know that her name was provided to members of the Senate and the FBI by a witness named Max Steyer, who is a good governance activist in Washington, who's a respected figure. And he had provided this name. The name is in documents. It's in a letter. He did at one point, I understand, do work for Williams and Connolly.
Oh, and I love it. It's my understanding that at some point in his career, I think he did something like that. He's a hardcore progressive ideological activist. That's kind of important to point out because there's a clear potential conflict.
Why wasn't that in the piece? Because that is, if we're talking about credibility.
Right. I understand. It's relevant background.
My apologies. I tend to do this. I stop them from finishing a thought before I jump in because they say things that are so mind-bogglingly stupid. Was that an oversight? Because you agree that it probably should have been put out there, and it's in the book. Was that another weird oversight?
This case, it was a very short mention, and we only talked in brief terms about what he's doing right now. So we didn't see all of that context to be necessary. But I understand why you're bringing it up, and I think it's fair.
They don't understand why it's important. Why it's necessary to point out that the only person that they have claiming this incident happened is someone who is deeply loyal to Hillary Clinton, who did not become president, who was not able to put up her own nominee for the Supreme Court. They don't think that's relevant, that potential conflict is relevant. They're making that decision for you because they know you won't have the same belief that she does. That you would say, of course that's relevant. That's incredibly relevant.
Well, you also sort of threw the New York Times opinion board under the bus a little bit, saying that they chose to omit it. I've written opinion pieces in the New York Times. In my experience, I get the final say on what runs. At least that's what happened with my recent. Mm-hmm. So where was the disconnect?
Well, we're a team at the New York Times. We have processes in place. We wrote this. It was edited. There was back and forth, as there always is. It's kind of a team effort, frankly, to make sure that everybody's comfortable with the final product. And there was just an oversight here. So did you guys miss it? Did you miss that was
somebody
so
missed
important? But you are the authors of the book. Did you just miss
it? It's in the book.
Yeah,
I miss it in the New York Times.
We first had it in the piece. And so it's about an editing process, which is iterative. It has a lot of different drafts. And, you know, I think actually the way it happened was the editors being concerned about naming her because the Times has a tradition of not naming the victims and really has to deliberate whether or not to.
But real quick, she's not a victim. If you believe she's a victim, you would say alleged victim, but continue.
Do that. In that sentence that had her name, it also had that she doesn't remember it. They took out the whole sentence, and in removing her name in order to kind of protect her and make sure we weren't sort of sending people to her door, we also took out.
Which, by the way, again, is kind of weird because she's still named her in the book, but here you're now defending why they didn't name her in the New York Times piece.
The fact that she didn't remember it.
Did you read it right before it went to print?
You know, we thought we had, and as soon as we realized this, we corrected it, and they wrote an editor's note, and they restored it.
But didn't you realize it because Molly Hemingway made the correction? And I just want to know, blankly, can you understand why so many people think that this might be an
hatchet
job?
Yes, and I actually think, Megan, it's a good point, because the reason we did this book in the first place was that this was such an incredibly polarizing event in our country's history. Everyone saw in it what they wanted to see.
As did you. And you decided to then turn this into, as Meghan McCain said just there, a hatchet job. Or a hack job. And that's exactly what this is. This is a very good interview. Kudos to the ladies of The View on this one. Because as much as I generally don't like about three of the four or five of them that are there, even the ones who generally side with progressive causes and progressive guests, even they push back. Because they realize exactly what this was, which was a total hit piece. 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text on the NumBetter Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-877. Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. Andrew Pollack experienced what no parent should, losing his daughter to a vicious act of craven violence. What makes the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, especially disturbing is people in policies actually created the shooter. That's what he believes. His book is called Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endanger American Students. Andrew co-wrote the book with Max Eden. Andrew Pollack joins me now. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's an important message.
So essentially, Andrew, you chose to relive the trauma of what you and your family actually experienced because you wanted to find out why this happened. So what about the events led you to believe that this wasn't simply some evil kid committing a series of grisly murders?
All the people that called me telling me that they knew he was going to be the shooter. That they knew he was a bad kid. They knew he threatened people's lives. They made reports to the school district. Just all the information that came out about the police going to his house 45 times. It took them months to get disciplinary records from the school district. Them not being transparent. And the questions when we asked the superintendent, Robert Runcie, the questions we asked him and the way he answered it led us to believe that they were covering something up that was just horrible.
So what policies did you find that you believe contributed to what happened at Stoneman Douglas?
Well, there's a couple of policies that we looked into. One was mainstreaming, their special needs kids with learning disabilities. There is no issues with dyslexia, autism. They're not disruptive. And we should help children like that. Let's mainstream them and help them with their education. But when they mainstream kids emotionally disturbed and with oppositional defiant disorder, that puts our kids in danger. These kids are psychopaths, and they label them emotionally disturbed. And that's a big problem in policy that's going on. The other issues are the leniency policies of not holding kids accountable. That's we have as records, and that's going on in the school, and it doesn't just go on in Broward. It goes on across the country, and in order to parents to know what's going on, they need to read my book, Why Meadow Died, so they could see all the multitude of failures that happened in Parkland, the truth, the actual documents from the school district of his discipline and the teacher, her records of how bad this kid was and how they allowed him to be in the school so dangerous. He was so dangerous they had to frisk him every day before school.
Wow.
That he wasn't allowed in with a backpack. Okay, that's how dangerous he was. And Broward County School District allowed this thing in the school with my daughter. And like I said, it's not only in Broward. It's going on throughout the country in thousands of schools.
So what do you think is what was the intent behind the actions of the school? I'm presuming you don't believe that there was nefarious intent, but what do you think motivated it?
Motivated the policies?
Yeah, motivated these individuals who clearly had concerns with the shooter, but decided to let him into the school anyway.
Just political correctness was one of them. The Broward County School Superintendent came from Chicago, And his intentions were to end the school-to-prison pipeline and end the discipline as we knew it, as it was in schools, which created a culture of leniency throughout the whole school district. And it led up to my daughter getting murdered by allowing this thing in the school and never getting arrested. He trespassed at the school. He wasn't arrested. He drew swastikas in the school.
Yeah.
He had N-word on his backpack. He threatened kids and kids' lives. He brought knives to school, bullets to school, never arrested. Would you want to send your child to a school where that was going on?
It's unbelievable, and I'm wondering from your perspective, and by the way, we're talking with Andrew Pollack. He's the author of the book, Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endanger America's Students. Is you're finding out all of this information that you clearly didn't know about beforehand. You know, how did you deal with this knowledge? Because I imagine, you know, most people would immediately get incredibly angry.
Well, I switched into gears of holding people accountable. And, you know, at first, when I was doing all this, I wanted to be the last parent to ever have to have a child murdered in a school. All right, but I saw that can't happen because there's school shootings that are going on. So I switched gears now. Now my thing is I want to be the last parent to say I didn't know what was going on in the schools. Okay? Parents have no excuse now to say that because my book is like a manual for parents and grandparents to read, to look into the facts of what happened in Parkland and see if it's going on in their child's school. Because ultimately, politicians can only do so much for you at your local level, okay? They can't fix your local school boards, okay? The president can't fix it. The governor can't fix it. The senator can't fix it. Only parents and grandparents and people in the district could fix what's going on in their school district. So they have no excuse now. Read my book. And then realize and go see, look into this, if these policies are at your child's school.
You did an interview the other day on Fox News, and there was something that you said that kind of struck a chord with me, that you felt like you had some sort of guilt of putting Meadow in a school where you didn't necessarily know about the safety concerns you now know of. Take us through.
Correct.
Take us through that emotion, because I have to assume that's incredibly difficult to deal with.
Well, I have to live with it. I put my daughter in the school, like all your listeners now. They drive their kids to school, and they think they're safe at the school. No matter, you know, they think you live in a great community, like I did. And my daughter was safe, and she wasn't, and she didn't have this type of element in the school, in her classes. Little did I know, they had to frisk the shooter every morning. That's how dangerous he was, and I didn't know. One summer, they were worried about there was a hatchet missing from his garage.
Jeez.
But it was okay to send this thing into the school with my daughter. Okay? He shouted he wanted to kill. The teacher puts in her notes he was a danger. She was worried he's a danger to the students and teachers. The teacher puts in her notes he couldn't differentiate violent video games from reality. Okay? And this is what I got to live with. I put my daughter in that school not knowing. Now, parents, they don't have the excuse. You know, this is what's going on in the schools, and you need to learn the facts, okay? If you want to know the true facts of what happened in Parkland, then read my book, Why Meadow Died, because it's all in there, laid out with the disciplinary notes, with the calendar that the teacher kept. It's all in there with the interviews of everyone who failed, and that's why it's a book, because so many people failed, and it's not even a failure. They were following policies from the superintendent, and these policies are throughout the whole country. They speak about it now. Gavin Newsom just signed a bill into law in California. It's illegal to suspend disruptive kids. That's the law in California now, and that's the type of discipline in Broward that got my daughter murdered.
The book, again, is called Why Meadow Died. It's an incredibly important book for you to read, whether or not you've got kids or are going to schools, because this is about the safety of our communities. You can purchase it right now at Amazon.com, wherever it is you buy books. Last question for you, Andrew.
Sure.
Who was Meadow? How will she be remembered?
Meadow was my daughter, and she was a fighter. She tried to save another student that day.
Yeah.
She was my baby. We called her Princess. She was enrolled in college. There wasn't anything she couldn't accomplish. And all this was taken from her and our family from just these policies and incompetence. Yeah. And I would hate for anyone to have to feel like I do for the rest of their lives. So it's imperative to learn about these things in this manual before you just think you're going to send your kid there and they're safe. So Meadow was my everything, and there's nothing I won't do to hold all these people accountable and to honor her. And honoring her is getting this book out so no other parent has to. Yeah. They could all see why Meadow died, okay, in this. And Meadow would want every parent to read it to know the truth of the facts of what happened in Parkland.
Well, we're here to help support you in this incredibly important mission of yours. Again, the book is called Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endanger America's Students. It's written by Andrew Pollack, co-written by Max Eden. Andrew, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I know it's incredibly difficult, and we wish you the best of luck. And again, we're out here supporting your message and the work that you're doing in the community. So thank you so much, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I appreciate you.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Good afternoon. Welcome back to The Jason Rand Show. We're live in the Online Trading Academy studio. Really do appreciate you tuning in. I would love it if all of you Seahawks fans would tune in at 5 o'clock. I mean, really, you should stay tuned in for the next hour and 10 minutes. But at 5 o'clock, I'm going to give you an opportunity to win a pair of tickets to this weekend's game as the Seattle Seahawks take on the New Orleans Saints. Are they good?
Well,
just say yes.
Yeah,
it's going to be a very competitive game.
I could have just given you a breakdown, but yeah, sure, they're good.
I don't want a breakdown. That's a
they have a backup quarterback in.
No, don't say that.
Why?
It's going to be a very competitive.
It's going to be a Hawks win.
Everyone's going to want to go.
Everyone's going to want to go anyway.
Want to see the Seahawks win.
It's a Hawks win.
Yeah, there you go. So if you want to be a part of that, I'm going to give you a keyword in the 5 o'clock hour, first segment. And then you can go online, enter that keyword for your chance to win a pair of tickets to this weekend's game. Be the talk of the town, because everyone's going to be all like, I want to go to the Seahawks game, but you know, sometimes they're a little bit too expensive. And then you're going to be like, I know, but you know how much mine costs? And they're going to be like, oh, it probably cost you like $400. You're like, nope. You go, what, $300? You go, nope. You go, what, two? Did you get a deal? Where'd you buy them? Did you steal them? You go, no, I want them. It cost me nothing. But about 10 minutes of my time. So stick around 5 o'clock. We're going to give you a chance to win a pair of tickets, as we do every single Tuesday before a home game, 8 a.m. on Saul Spady's show, 5 p.m. on my show. The Women's March apparently just kicked out some of their leaders. This is a couple of years after their anti-Semitism was pretty much out in the open, and they not only weren't apologizing for it, but they were kind of defending it. Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, they're being replaced. These are people who, let's just push aside for a moment the fact that they demonize Israel on a regular basis. Let's push that aside for a second. These are people who praise Louis Farrakhan many, 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 many times, including after, most recently, Louis Farrakhan gave that speech in which he called Jews termites. Just throwing that out there, that even after that, Tamika Mallory and Linda Sarsour didn't want to criticize their great friend, Louis Farrakhan. That's what bigots do. Support other bigots. So they are being asked to go. They're handling it in a very PR way. Just like, oh, you know, this is planned for some time. But let's look at who's going to replace Tamika Mallory and Linda Sarsour, two anti-Semites. The new board members were selected by a nominating committee and include three Jewish women. Rabbi Tamara Cohen of Moving Traditions. That's an educational program for Jewish teenagers. Gina Green, chief strategy officer of the liberal Jewish political advocacy group Bend the Ark. They advised the Women's March on anti-Semitism during the peak of the controversy, and they have one more woman whose name I don't have in front of me. This is very clearly not something that was simply planned. This is the Women's March finally doing what they needed to do, which is rid itself of the virulent anti-Semitism at the top. Now, I disagree with a lot of the political positions behind the leaders of the Women's March. That's okay. We get to disagree. But when you decide you're going to be a mainstream organization that is going to normalize the behaviors and beliefs of anti-Semites, one step too far, and that's no longer about me disagreeing with your political position. This is now me saying you're kind of giving this sort of backing or pat on the back to anti-Semites. You're normalizing the behavior at a time when anti-Semitic attacks and hate crimes are on the rise. So good riddance to these two vicious anti-Semites. And I do think the Women's March has to explain why it took so long for them to finally make this decision. 1-800-465-8770. If you text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, I'll send you my latest blog. Text R-A-N-T-Z to the number 1-800-465-8770. And I'll send you a surprising note from Seattle Public Schools that says, hey, their dress code now supports conservative clothing? It's a Jason Rantz Show.